Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Edward Sullivan, CEO and Managing Partner at Velocity Group. Hi, Edward.
Hey, Fred, how are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we would appreciate if you would take just a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Edward. So Edward, let's start with your experience so our listeners can get to know you. Tell us more about your background and how you went from consulting and coaching to your current role as CEO and managing partner.
Thanks, Fred. Yeah, you know, I got my start years ago, about 20 years ago, in politics. And I was working in different parts of the United States and different parts of the world, advising political leaders on campaign strategy, on leadership, on public speaking, et cetera. And that naturally transitioned at some point into working with business leaders. I have some experience working in Silicon Valley. I was in San Francisco for about 10 years. And it was actually one of my colleagues from business school. I went to Wharton as like a mid-career MBA student. And it was one of my business school classmates who asked me to coach her for the first time as her executive coach. Uh-huh. And it was interesting. Before I even finished business school, I was coaching at Google and Macy's and BCG and a number of other companies. And I thought, well, maybe this is something I should stick with.
Nice. That's a good way for you to come up. So you're like an accidental coach.
Yeah, I was kind of an accidental coach. I like to tell people I was drafted into coaching.
That's wonderful to know. So one of the most important things in leadership is building and having influence. What are some of the practical strategies that you can describe as to how leaders can achieve a level of influence to help employees see the bigger picture or even buy into a vision?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people think that there's only one way to have influence, and that's whatever way they try, right? Like people are very much, I think they're a hammer and they're walk around looking for a nail, as the old adage goes. And in my experience, the best leaders are very adaptable in their leadership style, and they change up their methods of influence to fit the person or the situation. Uh-huh. So the best leaders we work with are very curious, and they try to get to know people, and they try to figure out what makes people tick, and they use the appropriate influence styles with every person, as opposed to those people who they grew up having one style of working with people, and they use that style whether or not it works. And if you can be more nimble, listen, ask more questions, get to know people, you can figure out exactly the appropriate way of influencing them.
So I have a follow-up to that, and I'm just going to give you a scenario. Let's say you have a leader who has been very successful in doing things their own way, but the world is changing, you know, given where we are today, even compared to like 2 years ago. And we may have a situation where he's seeing or she's seeing something one way versus their team seeing something a completely different way. How would you come in as a coach and try and influence this person or make them see a different picture from what they already visualize in their own head?
Yeah, you know, we say in our work that sometimes clients have blind sets. A blind set is when you have a mindset that makes you blind to certain things, right? Uh-huh. And when the world is changing around you, you are sometimes in denial of that fact. And denial is one of the four blind sets we explore with our clients. And when someone is not able to really accept reality that things are changing, they need to learn to be more adaptable. They need to learn to see the writing on the wall. And in our work, we use the power of inquiry. We use powerful questions. We get feedback. We use data from their colleagues to show them what's actually happening and the ways in which they're purposefully or not, not accepting what is happening and not unable to see how things are changing around them.
So if I'm that, let's say, for example, I'm going to use myself as an example. If I am that leader who is not seeing things the way my team is seeing it, how do I get to know that I need a coach? Like, how do you guys come into the picture?
Yeah. I mean, the best clients are the clients who they don't even think they need a coach. They want to coach, you know? I mean, if you're going to be in the Olympics, you're going to have a coach, right? Everyone who wants to win the gold medal goes out and gets a coach because that's what you do in sports. And it's now becoming much more common in the business world to proactively go out and get a coach because we're building this business. We just raised money. I'm going to hire 50 more people. I want to get ahead of this. I'm accepting the fact there's probably things I don't know that I don't know. And working with a coach will open my eyes in certain ways. If we get called in and it's more of a problem situation, so there's something that needs to be fixed, it's actually less of an enjoyable coaching engagement because we're already starting on our back foot. Right. Sometimes we make very rapid change. You know, when there's a problem in a company, it's often something that people aren't seeing or accepting. And when we come in with fresh eyes, we can help leaders see the areas of the business that need to change, see the habits that they have that aren't really working, help them see the ways that they're impacting people positively or negatively. They may have blind spots. They may have unsung strengths, right? All these ways in which they're not fully seeing themselves. They don't have great self-awareness, nor are they really seeing their teams and what's happening in the business with clear eyes. And working with a coach can help them accomplish that. And sometimes just asking for feedback too. You know, right. The clients who are always asking for feedback, they're the ones who grow. They're the ones who stay curious. And ultimately, they're the ones who build the best companies.
So if you were to offer one quick tip to our listeners on ways that they can self-diagnose themselves in order to remove those, you know, those blind spots, what's the suggestion? How would you go about providing that kind of a tip?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing is to get feedback. If you can get honest feedback from your colleagues, from your friends, that's the place to start. If you're not sure that people can give you honest feedback, maybe they don't feel safe, maybe they don't want to upset you. There are anonymous feedback tools that you can use. You can find one on the internet where you basically, you do a 360 on yourself and you send out a survey to 6 or 10 friends or colleagues, asking them the questions you want answers to and letting them know that this is going to be an anonymous survey. I want you to tell me what's really going on. And it can be hard to read sometimes, right? Oftentimes when we're doing a 360, an anonymous 360 with our clients, there's information in there that's very difficult for them to read, but they know they need it and it helps them grow.
That's good. So they have to be open to even constructive criticism from their closest friends, even though it's anonymous.
Exactly. Exactly.
You've dealt with different types of leaders in South America, Africa, Europe, et cetera. What is the one behavior or trait that you have seen derail more leaders' careers?
You know, I would say there are actually two traits. So I'm gonna cheat a little bit and give you two traits.
It's even better than one. Let's hear it.
You know, the first one is arrogance. And when I say arrogance, I mean that leaders sometimes get to a place in their career where they've had enough experience or they feel like they've achieved a certain level of success. Well, they feel they are invincible. They feel like they always know the answers. Right. That actually is often a cover for them feeling a little bit like an imposter. So when I see someone who is very arrogant and very aggressive, it's normally covering up feelings of inadequacy. Everybody gets to a place in their career where they're like, how did this happen? How am I now the CEO? How am I now the president, right?
Right.
They've been planning for it for a long time. And then it actually happens and they look around, they go, oh my God, I hope no one realizes I have no idea what I'm doing. And that's what we call the imposter syndrome. And the easiest way for people to cover the imposter syndrome, to cover the fact that they don't have full confidence that they know what they're doing, is to be very arrogant and is to overcompensate. We've seen that in certain political figures over the last couple of years, and we certainly see it in sometimes in business. And the second way that leaders derail themselves is by allowing themselves to be surrounded by sycophants. And sycophants are those people who they kiss up in order to get something, right? We can also call them the yes men or the yes women.
That's exactly right? The word I was thinking about.
Yeah, it's those people who won't actually tell you the truth. They'll tell you what you want to hear. And many times leaders surround themselves by those people because it feels good. It feels good to be praised. It feels good to be told that you know that you're the best, that you have all the answers. But the best leaders we work with are constantly seeking, again, seeking feedback. They want constructive criticism. They want to create lively and spirited debate. They want to be told when they're wrong. And they surround themselves by people who will challenge them. Steve Jobs was great at that. My business partner did a lot of work at Apple in the 90s and in the 2000s and saw Steve Jobs in action quite a bit. And Steve Jobs loved to be challenged because he knew he was getting closer to the truth.
So
that's what great leaders do.
Yeah. So the attribute of wanting to be challenged could be by your peers, could be by your competitors, based on your viewpoint. Is that something that brings out the best in people because they accept that challenge and they want to prove people wrong?
Exactly. I mean, the challenge is basically, it's like the file that sharpens the knife. You know, we only get better through pressure. We only get better by being challenged. We only get better from feedback, right? And if we don't have that feedback, if things start to feel too easy, are we really improving? It's like someone who goes skiing and never falls. You know, when you're out on the slopes, you have to be leaning on those edges and really, really pushing yourself. And you'll probably fall a couple times a day. That means you're at living or skiing at your limit and ultimately getting better. Leadership is the same.
Wonderful. I mean, I would not be the one on the ski slopes, but I get that analogy. That's a good one. So part of your experience involves dealing with political leaders and different governments. In your estimation, what is the biggest challenge facing leaders in today's society? And with that, I'm not just talking about with the states, you know, we're talking global leadership, or even in business.
Well, the first thing is that it seems at this point that polarization and brinkmanship come before governance, right? Politics seems now more than ever about the fight and not about making decisions and governing. Even when I was growing up, you know, 20, 30 years ago, Democrats and Republicans came together to solve important problems. Now it seems that they use important problems as wedge issues to create drama, to create opposition, to mobilize their base. Everything seems to be about staying in power, building power, getting reelected, not about doing what's best for the country or for the people. I'd say that's the first thing. The second thing is, at the same time that our politicians are doing less and less around governance, we've never had bigger and bigger problems. The problems of social injustice, the problem of racial inequality, the problems of climate change, forest fires. Things are getting arguably worse from a political perspective. And we are certainly in very deep water from a climactic and environmental standpoint. And it seems like our political leaders have never been less able to come together and seek solutions.
Now, if we transition this to business, are there any noticeable differences in approaches employed between political leaders and corporate leaders? Please share any examples you may have.
I mean, the essential difference between politics and business, as I can see, is that zero-sum tactics in business tend to lead to bankruptcy, uh-huh. right? I mean, being very oppositional, being very caustic. In politics, that leads to re-election. But in business, that leads to going out of business, right? Right. So the other thing is business is what they call the infinite game. You're never really have won. You're only ahead. And someone else can come up from behind and take you out of that position. In politics, right. elections every 4 years, every 2 years, you win or you lose. You can run again, but for that period of time, you lost, right? Yeah. And elections are interesting that way because you can very quickly fall out of favor because of a single problem, right? We're seeing a lot of cancel culture these days. Right. And with politicians especially, things catch up with them very quickly. In business, you know, the business leader may get into trouble, but the business itself can survive. The business can swap out the leader. The CEO might get taken out, but uh-huh. the company can continue. And I think that's one of the essential differences as well between business and politics. Politics is really about the individual. And the risks that individual accepts. Do they win? Do they lose in the election? Uh-huh. In business, you know, there are brands, there are iconic companies that they occupy a space in our minds beyond their leaders. You know, we've seen that in many companies in recent years. There's been some scandal, some tragedy with the CEO or members of the board, and that person simply moves on. And the business itself can stand the test of time.
Yeah, and I can agree with that because this book that I read, I believe it came out this spring, it's about Amazon and mm-hmm. the viewpoint that Jeff Bezos takes on Amazon being a day one company. And it directly correlates to what you just said about, you know, you're a temporary occupant and you could be surpassed by a competitor down the line, you never know. And that's the mindset yeah. that he has at Amazon, which is, we got to operate with that day one mindset that mm-hmm. we're not that big, bad, bold company. Somebody one day will come and take our spot. So you have to keep innovating or else you'll be taken out.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, the best companies are constantly thinking 3 to 5 years ahead rather than 3 to 5 weeks ahead. And I will say that's probably another difference as well. You might argue that the Democrats and Republicans have long-term strategies for building their bases, but really 9 times out of 10, the only thing they're thinking about is the next election.
Absolutely. And it's a sad reality, but that's just how it is.
It is.
Yeah. So I want to talk about startups now. You've invested in over a dozen different startups over the years. What are some mm-hmm. of the attributes that you look for in a startup before deciding on whether to invest in them or not?
Hmm. I tend to invest in 3 different kinds of companies. One, I trust my network. So I tend to invest first and foremost in great companies that are started by people I know, people uh-huh. I trust, people whose work ethic I have been exposed to for a long time. And I know that they are in it to win it, right? I normally don't take random people pitching me. I get emails all the time. People contacting me through LinkedIn. I really don't take those meetings because I'm not a venture capitalist. I don't have time to take dozens of meetings a week for investments. So I generally source investments through my network. I also source investments in innovative technologies that are aimed at making the world a better place through my network. So I might not know the entrepreneur, but I know other people who are looking at the business and kind of giving me exposure to interesting deals that way. And then the third category of investments I do, and I've been making more investments alongside my partner and through the business, is with our clients. We have a great list of clients we work with, some of the best companies in Silicon Valley and frankly, best companies in the world right now. Uh-huh. And because of our relationship, we sometimes have access to small allocations in their growth rounds. It's not the same as investing in a very, very early stage startup, but you know, when we've been working with a company for a year or two, we know the CEO, we know their strengths and their weaknesses as leaders, their strengths and weaknesses as businesses. We can make very good decisions to invest in their growth rounds, Series B, Series C. Uh-huh. And it's an interesting strategy for us. We've been teasing with the idea of actually starting a venture fund specifically to invest in our clients, because we just work with so many great companies.
And that's wonderful. And for our listeners who want to get an in-depth perspective on the kind of companies that Edward invests in, take a look at his LinkedIn. That's where I saw them, and it was remarkable. You know, it's not easy to get, you know, good investments. There's a lot of startups right now, and you want to make sure that if you're choosing to invest, you want to put your money into something that has a higher degree of being successful. So for your listeners, just go take a look at Edward Selvin's LinkedIn profile, and you'll see all that information on there. Switching gears, let's talk about your book, Leading with Heart. Sure. What was your motivation to write it, and what do you hope the readers take away from having read it?
You know, we're a small firm. We're two partners. We're 25 coaches. We work with about 100 different companies, a couple hundred leaders. And we realized that our approach to coaching and our approach to leadership is somewhat unique. We're very interested in helping leaders figure out their own strategies and their own tactics and frameworks for leadership. We don't really believe in the cookie cutter approach. We don't believe in the simple hacks to be a better leader. We really think that every leader needs to develop their own authentic way of leading, rather than just picking it up from a simple book. So the interesting thing is, why didn't we write a book if we don't, we think everybody should write their own or have their own authentic brand for leadership? That's actually the book we wrote. Leading with Heart is really a book that helps leaders develop their own playbooks, as opposed to adopting the playbook of someone else, right? Every leadership book out there is a memoir, or it's a, you know, 10 steps to do this, or uh-huh, the best way to do that. And we started with questions about how to connect with people, how to really understand your own needs and the needs of your team, how to understand fear and how fear can become a problem that hinders our ability to communicate, our ability to make great decisions. In the book, we're also exploring the real desires and motivators that people have, how that can be really inspiring and motivating, but also how that can be derailing.
Right.
And then we also talk about learning how to understand and tap into people's gifts and their sense of purpose. Because if you can really look inside someone and see what they're especially gifted at, even if they don't know it, you can bring out a capacity in them that they don't even know for themselves. So the book is ultimately an answer to that question of, like, what does great leadership look like? We think it looks like however you do it most naturally, and however you do it that enables you to connect deeply and at a real level with yourself and your team.
So if I'm following correctly, it's more about an inside out approach. You're looking at your own, you know, skills, your own personality, and see how that can bring out the best in you from a leadership perspective, versus just taking somebody else's book and how that worked for them and trying to apply it to yourself.
That's exactly right. Inside Out. We should probably change the name of the book to Inside Out Leadership, because that works great too.
If you do that, I want some royalties.
You got the royalties. No worries.
Awesome. Oh, is the book released already?
No, the book. I actually just hit send on the email to our publisher this morning. Awesome. With the final manuscript. So we have
congratulations, man.
Thank you. Thank you. We're very excited.
It's so been a once year. Going to say, once the book has been released, we'll add that to the episode notes so that the listeners, future listeners, once the book is released, you can just click on the link from the episode notes and just go and download it from there or purchase it from there.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. That'll be exciting.
Lastly, this is one of my favorite questions, because like I said, different leaders have different things that help them get to where they are. And I'm curious, you know, to get your perspective on this. What has helped you get to where you are now? And what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's identical to yours?
You know, the best coaches we work with have, first and foremost, deep personal experience working as an operator or an entrepreneur. Everybody we work with has 10 years of experience working in business. I think there are a lot of great people out there who are getting into coaching, and they're young and they're excited, and they could be fantastic life coaches. There's lots of like men's group coaches out there, people who are helping individuals figure out what to do with their lives, or figure out what their gift is, or figure out what their purpose is. And that's a whole school of coaching that I think is really important and really valuable. And I also think executive coaching is a little different, because executive coaching is about helping leaders build businesses. And it helps. It's not entirely necessary, but it really helps that you have business experience, because the best coaches we work with, they speak startup, right? They get the language. Most of them have MBAs, right? They've all worked at companies like Uber and Google and GE and Facebook, and they understand the ins and outs of Silicon Valley. That gives them a benchmark, a baseline of understanding of how businesses really work, that they can then build upon with their coaching expertise. And the second thing is, when I'm looking for new coaches, I'm actually looking for coaches who got into coaching in a similar way I did. They were drafted. Somebody saw in them a unique ability and a way of connecting that made them interesting to others. And people viewed them as a resource that they were seeking coaching from. A lot of folks get to a point in their career where they just want to take it easy, and they want to do something a little bit less stressful, and they get into coaching. I think that's great. But the important thing is, the most important thing is not, do you want to be a coach? It's, do people want to be coached by you?
Right.
And some people come to me and they'll say like, hey, I'm having a really hard time building up the business. I don't have the client list. I'm not attracting clients. And that's information. It's really good information, right? They might be doing something wrong. That's very simple. Or they may not be approaching the coaching art, and I believe it is an art, with the right mindset. They might be going in and trying to fix people. They might be trying to solve everyone's problems. And really, if you're a problem solver, you're more of an advisor, right? You're a consultant. Difference between advising and consulting is, advisors come with great solutions, great answers. Coaches come with powerful questions. An advisor is no longer valuable when they don't have the answer. A coach can always ask a more powerful question. And that's how we think about it. Through coaching, we build problem-solving capacity. We don't solve people's problems for them. It's very different.
I like that approach and that holistic explanation. So, Edward, thanks a lot for joining us today. You've shared a lot of knowledge, and hopefully our listeners will find a lot of value in some of those principles that you've shared.
Thank you, Fred. It was really a joy speaking with you.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.